Good afternoon. Why don't we begin? My name's Jennifer Cook. I'm co-director of the Africa program here at CSIS, along with Steve Morrison, who's over here. Today's event is looking at international collaboration on Darfur, and we have three very distinguished leaders to talk about this, to talk about how international collaboration has evolved in addressing the crisis in Darfur, how effective it's been in moving forward the political and security situations, and where in the future are opportunities where a collaborative international approach, or at least a complementary international approaches, can have some bearing in resolving the political, security, and humanitarian situation ongoing in Darfur. All of this, I think, as you know, is in the face of a situation that is looking extremely bleak, intractable, and in which the calculations of the proliferating actors on the ground look like they're leading to greater intractability and really not less. The hybrid African Union-UN peacekeeping force, which has been such an enormous focus of the international community, some would say a disproportionate focus of the international community, and in which so many hopes are resting right now, is running into persistent resistance, delays, and backpedaling by the government in Khartoum. And the security situation that those troops will face has morphed into something that will be very difficult for even the best-equipped and mobile troops, peacekeeping troops, to manage. With a proliferation of armed groups, IDP camps that are increasingly radicalized and militarized, and really a situation, as I say, that I think even the most competent global peacekeeping force is going to have very difficult time managing. On the political front, it is the continued recalcitrance of Khartoum, and at this point, almost equally problematic, the splintering of rebel factions, the development of a war economy, and an increasingly tenuous link between rebel leaders and, of course, the government of Khartoum, and the civilians' populations on whose behalf they purport to act. Finally, this occurs in a national context that is looking increasingly fraught. The comprehensive peace agreement between North and South, which was such a signal achievement of the international community, has foundered badly and probably hasn't received the kind of careful international stewardship and shepherding that peace agreement was going to require in order to be successful. And then the risk of violence in the South, both in the South, dangerous tensions in Kordofan, and kind of increasing radicalization of various voices within both North and South. Here to talk about international collaboration, we have really straight from the source. I was going to say straight from the horse's mouth, but I don't know if that translates well in Chinese. It's meant to be a compliment. We have Ambassador Liu, who was appointed in May as the special representative of the Chinese government for African affairs and special envoy to Darfur. Ambassador Liu has been extremely active, very mobile and energetic on the issue. He has a longstanding commitment to Africa more broadly. He was ambassador to the Republic of South Africa from 2001 to 2007. He was Director General of the Department of African Affairs from 1998 to 2001, and we're just delighted that he's here with us today. We have also Sam Ibak, and Sam has been really at the center of the African Union's efforts to build peace and security capacity from the establishment of the African Union. He is currently the chief AU negotiator and the principal advisor to the AU Special Envoy for Darfur. From 2006 to 2007, he was head of the Darfur Peace Agreement Implementation Team. He previously, as I said, he was director of the Peace and Security of the AU Peace and Security Mechanism at the AU. For that was from November 2002 to July 2006. And prior to that, Director of Political Affairs at the Organization of African Unions. So he's been grappling with these issues of conflict and mediation for many years, and probably has met perhaps his biggest challenge in the current period. Finally, we have Andrew Natsios, who is the president's special envoy to Sudan. Andrew has a long-standing commitment to Sudan and to Africa. From 2001 to 2005, he was administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development. He was special coordinator for the International Disaster Assistance and special humanitarian coordinator for Sudan. Prior to that, service to USAID, first as director of the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance from 89 to 91, and then assistant administrator for the Bureau of Food and Humanitarian Assistance. So for a long commitment to the humanitarian and the well-being of people in Africa, and in particular in Sudan. So I think we'll lead off with Andrew, and then turn to Sam, and finally to Ambassador Liu. I think 10 minutes or so apiece, because we have a very interested audience here, and we can open it up for discussion following. So welcome to all three, and the floor is yours.
We've all decided to talk a half an hour each, so there will be no time for questions that could be embarrassing or difficult to answer. So that's actually a joke, but okay. Let me sort of describe, one, where what the situation is now, characterize the situation, and then where I think we've succeeded and where we need to work harder and where we go into the future. The first thing, I think we can characterize the current circumstances in Darfur as anarchy. And I don't mean that in a classical political science sense. Control of the central government is extremely weak in all areas except for the large cities. And a couple of times earlier this year, even broke down there. There were conflicts between the Janjaweed in two cities and the police force. And the police were shooting Janjaweed, and the Janjaweed were shooting the police in one of the markets. And this was not misreported. I got actually direct eyewitness accounts of what happened. Right now, a major event has taken place. I don't think Abdelwahid Nour wants to have it publicized, but I mean, I don't think there's a lot of media here, and I don't want to involve myself in the rebel politics of the province, but he is apparently in discussion, maybe even had alliance with one of the major Janjaweed leaders, his name is Hamadi, and he is from the Abala Rizagat, and he has a lot of military forces. Abdelwahid's forces are actually relatively weak on the ground militarily. His support is principally in the displaced camps, even though from my perspective and talking with a lot of people, those forces are diminishing, or his organizational structure is beginning to weaken now because people are getting more and more impatient with the whole process, and people are telling us that they're tired of this long wait, they want to go back home. There is a serious problem, I think, in timing of all this, which we're forgetting. The people in the camps are telling us, of all the rebel movements and the ethnic groups, that unless they're back in their villages, they refuse to register to vote. And there is a real risk, if this peace process takes too long, that it's too long for the registration process to take place, that the Sudanese government, for reasons, I mean, they have many reasons not to want to have anyone in Darfur vote, because they'll lose the vote if they do. The longer we wait to have a peace agreement, the less likely people will be registered to vote. And what could happen in Darfur is what happened in the mid-1980s, in the election that brought Sadiq al-Mahdi to power. The South was basically excluded from that election for the same reason. And if that happens again in Darfur, I believe it will increase substantially the unrest, and it will diminish even further the control of the central government in the province. One of the things that's lost here in Washington, I think, sometimes, is that the neighboring countries, Libya, Chad, Egypt, and Eritrea, have far more influence than the international community do. I don't want to go into details because they get very upset if you describe in detail. We know what they're doing. They actually tell us what they're doing in some cases, in some detail. They are heavily involved in this. They have geostrategic interests. They have ethnic interests. They have political interests there. And what happens is very important to them. And if we do not include them in this process, they can undermine a peace agreement. There's some evidence that the Darfur peace agreement of last year, one of the principal factors in its weakening after it was signed, was the fact that the regional powers did really not want it to be signed or implemented. There are other levels of complexity, and that is there are many regional organizations involved. The Arab League is involved, the African Union is involved, the European Union, of course, the United Nations. It is that level in terms of multilateral organizations. The P5 are deeply involved in this. That is why two of the three of the five P5 are sitting here in terms of representatives of their government. There's been a renewed interest since President Sarkozy was elected in French involvement in this in a major way, I must say, a very helpful way, in my view. The French have a sophisticated understanding of African politics, and my good friend Dr. Bernard Kouchner has been, very creative in some of the things he's proposed. The United States strongly supports the European Union's idea, it's beyond an idea now, of sending a force of substantial size to stabilize the situation in Chad. We urge very strongly the Europeans to go ahead with that because we think it sends a message that we should avoid the impression that atrocities can be created or are committed against displaced people or against civilians generally with impunity. And I think with a European force there, it can send a message that's no longer acceptable. I think the coordinated approach we're now taking through what is called the Tripoli format is helping to draw in the regional organizations, the four regional powers, and the international community in an organized way. It's difficult to do. This is very complicated and very structurally difficult to move through, but I think the UN has done a reasonably good job under the circumstances in beginning the process. Last summer, we really didn't have a high prospect of even starting the process. It is now started. I think very bumpy. I mean, most of the rebels didn't come. I had called one rebel leader, it was very interesting, who I knew, and I said, "Why aren't you here?" He said, "My men do not understand why, Andrew, that I would prefer being at this meeting rather than being with them. They have a lot of internal organizational issues." There was breakdown of that particular movement. And he said, I said, "Well, we need you here. You need to come." And he said, "Well, my men have told me if I come, they're going to kill me." And I said, "I don't think that's very humorous." He said, "I'm not joking. They told me they're going to kill me, and I think they are going to kill me if I leave, so I can't come, Andrew." And that's, and he wasn't joking. We found out later that there was enough unrest within the movement that literally if he had come to the movement, his own men would have killed him. People think that there's this orderly system of political leader, the rebel commanders, and the men. That is not the way it works. This is like a pool table where a ball has been hit, and the movements are reforming and recreating themselves as we speak, literally from week to week. So it's a very, very unstable situation on the rebel side. Several intelligence organizations are now saying there are 27 separate rebel movements and political leaders. 27 movements. There were only 13 last fall. The very creation of this process has led to a further factionalizing or balkanization of these movements. And unless we deal with that, which is being done now, we're going to have serious problems in holding negotiations. You can't hold negotiations easily between multiple partners. But with 27 groups, you can't hold them at all. It's ridiculous. It doesn't work. What's surprising is that the issues that are the central to this whole process are basically agreed on by most of the 27 groups. The big issue is egos. It's tribal tensions, which are very powerful despite what the rebels say. They said tribes have nothing to do with this. It's complete nonsense. They have an enormous amount. As the balkanization has taken place and as anarchy has spread across the province, tribes now make a much greater degree of difference in the political structure of Darfur than they ever did before. And so the tribes are, in fact, in many ways, reemerging as a powerful unifying force. We have to have, essentially, in order to get an agreement, several factors or several conditions. The first is we must have the support of the bulk of the Four population. There are about 2 million Four. We don't know exactly how many, but it's the largest tribe. They were there before. They have several leaders. Abdelwahid is the most prominent one. He's in Paris, although, as I said, there's evidence that his influence is diminishing. Two, we have to have the bulk of the Four farmers with us, IDPs and people still in their villages. And secondly, we have to have the Zagawa. The Zagawa are only 200,000. Most of the military defeats, in fact, virtually all of the military defeats of the Sudanese military are from Zagawa commanders and Zagawa soldiers. Does not mean other people aren't fighting. The Mazalit are fighting and other, but in terms of military prowess and in terms of powerful forces on the ground, we must have the Zagawa commanders or this is not going to work. We have a serious problem in most of the movements now in command and control between the troops and the commanding military officers. There's a gap between them. And sometimes the commanders are prisoners of their own men, literally. We saw this in other civil wars. This is not a new kind of a pattern. And there's a gap between the commanders and the political officers. Most people don't know, but we almost had the North-South Agreement come undone at the last stages of the CPA negotiation because there was a revolt of the commanders against John Garang, led, interestingly enough, by Salva Kiir. And it was, we sent in, the U.S. government sent a team in to put the revolt down. I mean in a diplomatic sense, by getting everybody together and cooling everyone down. But the fact is the commander said, we're the soldiers here. You're not consulting us about the provisions in the CPA. There is a real possibility that we could actually get a political negotiation going and resolved with a document. And then the commander say, wait a second, we didn't agree to this. These political leaders did not consult us first, which is, again, a serious problem that needs to be dealt with. I think we need to have civil society involved in this. Women's groups, local NGOs, the traditional tribal chiefs, including, I might add, the Arab tribal chiefs. One of the reasons Hamadi, I think, has joined Abdelwahed is that the soldiers who come, or the militia that supports the government, or used to support the government, that come from the Abala Rizagat, are extremely upset that they're being left out of this process. And some of the leaders told me that they're not going to support anything unless they have their own people. The government does not support them. I had more and more Arab leaders tell me the government does not represent them. And they don't want their interests being represented by the central government because they'll be betrayed again. And so you have this phenomenon. There's also a real risk right now of the Nazir of the Bagara Rizagat, the cow-herding Rizagat of the south, who've been neutral from the beginning, engaging in a jihad. There's real serious rumors of this happening now, and my friends are very nervous that they are going to enter the fray once in a way that could be very destructive. They've been quite neutral, and the Nazir, who's been a hero in many respects in the peace process, because he will not put his men on either side, that has begun to break down in the last couple of months. In the last week, it's actually accelerated. I think we need to communicate directly because most of the people are getting most of their information in the camps through the rebel movements, and they bias things just as the government distorts things. They use information for propaganda purposes. There needs to be an unbiased, honest reporting of what is going on in the peace process. That in and of itself will discipline the more obstructionist rebel leaders because we've noticed we did the same thing in a couple of other places. And one of the reasons we got a political agreement in Cambodia was that UN radio, which broadcasts the whole country, actually overcame the opposition of the Khmer Rouge to the elections by using the radio. We think it can be very powerful in the camps, but also in society generally, along with the participation of civil society, these traditional leaders, the IDP leaders. Right now we're having a problem because the Sudanese government is disrupting the IDP election process to choose advisory councils to then select people to go to the, and we strongly urge the Sudanese government to stop doing this. There are also, it's very disturbing to me, threats, the UN has reported, Jan Eliasson has reported it, that Abdelwahed Nour's forces are physically threatening people in the camps, that if they participate in this process, they will be physically at risk. That's unacceptable. It's unacceptable. There is also a risk of renewed fighting between Chad rebels and the government of Chad that's now accelerating. That will complicate regional stability. We wouldn't even be where we are now if there had not been a working ceasefire between the Sudanese government and the Chadian government. So I think there are whole levels of complexity that have to be dealt with. It's complicated. It can be done. But the most important thing is it's going to take a long time to do this. If anybody thinks all of a sudden we're going to have in 2 days some agreement, I think they're going to be sadly disappointed. That does not mean we shouldn't continue to do what we're doing. It simply means it's going to take longer and we need to be more patient as long as it's necessary to get this agreement signed. If we don't have a political agreement, the evidence should suggest from empirical studies that have been done at the UN for the last 40 years. They just did a study. I think it was USIP that did a 4-volume study of peacekeeping operations. David, is that correct? Yeah, and what it shows, as I recall, I didn't read all of it, is there is a direct connection between success and having a political agreement. Having a political agreement increases the likelihood that a peacekeeping force will be successful because you have something to enforce. Right now, we don't have something to enforce. We don't have broad agreement, so it's going to be harder. We need to do both of these in tandem. We need to have the political negotiation going on as the troops are arriving, and they've begun to arrive. And finally, just to say this, the United States is, with the British government, actively transporting troops. We've moved a Rwandan battalion, the United States. We've equipped them, we trained them, and we moved them in. The British have done that with a Nigerian battalion, and we will continue to do that. We're actively engaged in that process now. And I might add that there's some comments in the paper from Ban Ki-moon and other people that we need certain kinds of forces present. Senior leadership of our government at a very senior level are now engaged and have been for several weeks in the process of calling their counterparts in other countries to recruit the forces that have not volunteered yet that we need to complete this. So that's been going on. We don't advertise it. I'm saying it now because I get a little annoyed when it looks like our government's not doing anything, which is complete nonsense. There have been many meetings held on this. I was in the meetings with the secretary when she gave assignments to people, and she herself took some of the assignments, and we're moving along in the process. But it takes longer than it looks from the outside. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And that leaves plenty of time for tough questions, too. So, Sam Ibak, would you like to stand or speak from where you are?
I
stand, okay.
Well, thank you very much. After Mr. Natsios has spoken, it's pretty difficult to say a lot more as usual. But I want to start by saying that it's a good opportunity to be here. I couldn't help noticing that I was sitting there and I was sandwiched between an American and the latest kid on the block in Africa, the Chinese. And I was also feeling very comfortable because for the first time our friends from the U.S. and our friends from China are coming together and have been working together for the cause of peace in one of the most troubled parts of our continent. This is significant, and I'm going to come back to it later. There are three significant aspects to the problems in Darfur, which I think all of you are familiar with. There is the greatest manifestation of the tragedy that has unfolded in that part of Africa, which is the humanitarian. There is the security, and of course, there is the political. Basically, the problem in Darfur is a political problem. Sometimes, as we are most often inclined to do in different parts of the world, but particularly in Africa, there is a political problem, and we try to solve it through military, or try to apply military solutions to it, both in terms of the protagonist, but also in terms of the international response. And so you see the first response of the international community is to believe that we are going to deploy UNAMID. UNAMID is going to be 26,000 or whatever the numbers, and UNAMID is going to perform some miracles in Darfur. But I want to put it to you that the problem in Darfur is political, very, very political. It stems out of years of marginalization, years of inflicting the worst kinds of abuses on the people of Darfur, and years of the worst kinds of man-made inhumanity and abuses on a set of people. The people of Darfur are very traumatized, and there's not going to be a solution to it unless we begin to rebuild their lives, to rebuild their social fabric, to build them block by block. And the only way that you can do that is through a political process, a credible and genuine political process that goes to the root of the difficulties there. The humanitarian problem is being attended to, and thanks to many of the agencies, most of them Western, predominantly Western, and this country can afford to take pride in what your people have done in Darfur. The humanitarian bills in Darfur alone is something to the tune of about $700 million, are above. I think it must have gone up now. But the humanitarian space is shrinking. And you don't have the kind of disasters that you want to have in many parts of, in many conflict situations. But those who are working in Darfur are working under very great challenges, day-to-day challenges that many people would not want to subject themselves to. So I think, you know, that in looking at Darfur, we have to look at the totality of the problem. We have to try to design a comprehensive solution to the problem, because unless we do that, we're inclined to fail. Deploying UNAMID alone will not resolve the problem of Darfur. And also continuing to spend 700 million or more on humanitarian assistance is not going to resolve the problem. It's going to make the people dependent, and these people are not naturally dependent people. They're people who are used to working. They're people who are used to fending for themselves. They're used to farming, and they're used to different forms of livelihood. But they are becoming dependent. The IDP camps are becoming centers of pools of attraction because people find it easier to go there. There is security there, better security, relatively speaking. There is also assistance which is provided. I come from the position of being involved in the political process, and the prognosis is not very good, as Mr. Natsios has pointed out to us. We have a very difficult political process, which is a manifestation of the difficult challenges that you have in the government. I don't have any good news for you, because I think, I mean, if there are media people here, media people normally look for the headlines. They want the headline news. Unfortunately, there is none in Darfur, and maybe there is, because it is the bad news that makes news, depending on how you look at it. And the bad news is that we don't see any light at the end of the tunnel. Maybe the light that we see is the light of an approaching train, you know, and that's very troubling for many of us. I take the three categories of parties who are involved in the political process. The government of the Sudan. The government is looking good today because of the fragmentation of the movement. The government says it's ready for negotiations. It's sitting there. But the reality and the fact is that the government is not ready. The enabling environment for negotiations is not there. There is supposed to be a government of national unity in the Sudan. You don't have that government of national unity today as it was envisaged. The SPLM is still out of the government. And of course, the other major signatory to the DPA, Mini Minawi, is hardly a partner that you can talk about. And so two things I want to happen. First, the movements are not going to negotiate with the National Congress Party because they want to negotiate with the government of national unity. And the problems between the SPLM and the NCP have not yet been resolved. So it is up to us, the friends of the Sudan, to try to encourage the government to try to find accommodation with the NCP, because I think it is in their best interest. It is that partnership serves both of them. And I think that the way that the Sudan is shaping out, neither of them can do without the other. And so it is in the interest of the country, it is in the interest of the SPLM, it is in the interest of the NCP to find some kind of rapprochement and to resolve the problem. If we don't resolve the problem, the danger, and what I see, is that the comprehensive peace agreement runs the risk of unraveling. And if that happens, then you can forget about peace in Darfur. You can even forget about peace in the Sudan. And that's a very dangerous prospect, because it is not only Sudan that you're talking about. You're talking about the whole of the region. You're talking about our continent, because what happens in the Sudan is sooner or later bound to have an implication or bound to have an impact on the rest of the continent. We are going to the negotiations ostensibly to review the Darfur Peace Agreement. The Darfur Peace Agreement was signed by only two parties, Mini Minawi and the government of the Sudan. And when we met in Sirte, Mini Minawi was not there, so he claims he was not represented. And so that creates a problem of the legitimacy of the new process, because how do you go to change, amend, or whatever, an agreement that has been signed by two parties and only one of the parties is there? we wanted to start the process with the ceasefire agreement, the cessation of hostilities agreement. How do you do that when the forces of Mini-Minawi have not been integrated into the Sudan armed forces? They are still standing alone. And if you know Darfur, some of the big abuses which are being committed today are committed by forces who used to be loyal to Mini-Minawi. So who is going to take responsibility for the forces of Mini-Minawi? How can you have a credible cessation of hostilities or ceasefire if you don't have Mini-Minawi on board? And how can you have a credible political process when people are talking and shooting at each other at the same time? So that's for the government. But then you come to the part of the movements. Unfortunately, in Darfur, you don't have an ANC, you don't have one of the established parties that you have in other parts of Africa or other parts of the world. These groups have barely been in existence for 3 years or 4 years at the most. And within that 3 years, they have spent the 3 years fighting against each other as well as fighting against the government. They have spent that 3 years facing the onslaught of the government, which has done everything to fragment them, which have done everything to put them apart. And so they have not been able to achieve the necessary internal cohesion and the necessary internal capacity that would enable them to go into negotiations. To force them today to take them to negotiations, to take them to a negotiating table, is to really create more worse problems than we had in Abuja. Because the situation is going to inherently get worse. They don't have the clarity about what it is, what they are looking for, what their final objectives. The views on the issues are almost the same, because they are what we call the people's issues, the issues of security, the issues of compensation, the issues of ending the marginalization, the wealth sharing, and all of that. There's no problem with that. But who is going to do what? If there should be peace today in Darfur, who is going to do what? Who is going to be where? The problems of the egos of the people, you know, the problems, the challenge of having internal organizations that can drive such a complicated political process, it doesn't exist. And when people talk about delays in the process, timelines being given, I think we are totally unrealistic. But the most important part of the problem is the fact that because of what has happened in Darfur, we have grown accustomed to wanting to end that problem as quickly as possible, understandably so. But in doing so, we have also created expectations on the part of the people who are defending the rights of the Darfurians. They have come to depend, they have come to expect, they have come to hope that a solution to their problem is going to come from the outside. They have come to expect that, you know, they can wait, you know, and that something is going to give, something is going to happen. And so there is a false sense of complacency that, to the extent that today in Darfur, there is a perception, an increasing perception, that the international community is more desperate for peace in Darfur than the Darfurians themselves. They don't seem to understand why would people be pushing them to go into negotiations, you know, when they are not ready. They're not ready, they have told you they're not ready. So it's a very serious challenge. How do we bring some internal cohesion, some internal capacity to the movements and to put them to level the playing field, to face a very organized and a very determined opponent, which is the government of the Sudan? And it is difficult for you to place both the victim and the victimizer on the same level. Therein lies the dilemma that we all collectively face. How is it that we can address the problem with the government of the Sudan? We can have a sense of urgency, because every day that passes, the situation in Darfur continues to deteriorate. I was in Darfur for the first time in 2003, and I have noticed and I have witnessed the significant degradation of the political, of the security, of the humanitarian situation. You go to Darfur, many parts of it, there are deserted villages. There's nobody there. People are not there. Where are the people? The people are not there anymore. There are burnt villages and all of that. And it is worsening, because the fragmentation which has taken place with the movement has now been extended to the people of Darfur. And now you're beginning to have the kind of polarization where people talk about the ethnic problem in Darfur, the problem between the the Arabs and the Africans, the problems between the Fur and the Zagawa. And that is the worst part of it, how to pick up those pieces. And the Arabs are now saying, the new Arab resurgence, are saying, you know, the international community has always accused us of being part of the problem. Now we must be part of the solution, otherwise there will be no solution. And if you were to follow that kind of logic, where then are you going to put the Fur? Whose majority of people are staying in the camps, are the victims in the camps? You know, so the Darfur gets more complicated and more complex every day. How do you involve civil society? Mr. Nasius talked about civil society. There is a genuine expectation within Darfur and outside Darfur for the involvement and for the engagement of the civil society. But what is civil society in Darfur? Whose civil society are you talking about in Darfur? Because Darfur is a very polarized society. The movements tell you, look, we don't want civil society. We have to have a say in the civil society that you must bring to the table. Now, they want their own. That means they want their own civil society. The government says, we want civil society, but we must have a say in the... So the government wants its own civil society. Now, which of these, how do you therefore find the people? Therein lies that challenge. How do you bring in the Arabs? How do you bring in the Fur? How do you bring in the Zagawa? How do you bring in the Mesalit and the rest of the groups? I would just conclude this brief statement by saying, I would disappoint those who think that there is going to be a quick fix solution in Darfur. Unfortunately, there's not going to be one. And there is going to be a long-term framework for resolving Darfur, because the problem of Darfur is very deeply rooted. And what we can do if we want to help the Darfurians is to be able to have a framework that will help them to go back to their traditional methods of resolving problems and conflict resolution practices, because therein lies the solution to it. The solution that we try to impose from outside will collapse just as much as the DPA collapsed. We must return the political process to the people of Darfur. We must make sure that we create an enabling environment for them to sit across each other and for them to sit under those trees in Darfur as they used to do, and to find a solution that would best address their problems, because they used to live together in so many years back. We must begin to rebuild that social fabric that will give them the confidence that has been destroyed by years of what has happened in the recent past. And so that solution will only come if we work together, if we are able to come together, the United Nations, the African Union, the rest of the international community, the direct engagement, the kind of engagement, and I had to say it because he is here, because I have watched since Mr. Nasius came into office, into his present appointment, the risk that it takes going to Darfur. We need people not to sit in Washington and to make decisions about Darfur. We need people to go on the ground in Darfur and see what is happening. We need people from Beijing to go to Darfur and sit in Darfur and sit under the tree with the people. We need them to go from Nigeria, from wherever, to go and sit with the people of Darfur. Enough of the imposition of solutions from outside. And with all of the respect that I have for groups like the Save Darfur Coalition, we need them to be practically to know what it is that the expectations that they're creating in Darfur, because there is a rising expectation in Darfur that there's going to be some magical solution to all of the problems. And that expectation is something that we need to manage. Because we are not able to manage it so far, there is an increasing revolution of rising frustrations. People are getting frustrated, and frustrated people are doing things which are frustrating all of the processes. But we need to go on the roots. We don't need people to analyze the situation of Darfur from a distance. Those who want to really help must understand the dynamics of what is happening in Darfur. We must work together. We must hold hands together. We must begin to find the nexus between humanitarian assistance and begin to move people from humanitarian assistance to reconstruction and development, even while all of these processes are taking place. Because therein lies the solution. People want to see peace dividends. The people of Darfur for 3 years or 4 years have not seen anything. We've been talking about peace. We've been talking about, we have been having endless meetings in Africa, so many summits, in at the United Nations, so many summits. But what have the people of Darfur seen? They have seen years of increasing degradation of their communities, the destruction of the environment. That is what they have been seeing. And so the time has come that those who really want to help Darfur should help the political process. Those who really want to help Darfur should help to ensure that the government of the Sudan understands that things have gone seriously wrong in Darfur and that you need to have a quick deployment of UNAMID. We need to ensure that there is an engagement from across the board, engagement by the Americans, engagement by the Chinese, and I'm happy that the Chinese have sent an engineering brigade to UNAMID. That is important. Because the message which comes from the international community must be one clear signal that all of us are working towards the same purpose. We must not make the government or the movements feel comfortable that they are going to be protected or they are going to be defended, that when a matter goes to the Security Council, that one or the other members of the Security Council is going to defend what has happened in Darfur, because what has happened in Darfur is indefensible. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ambassador Liu, the floor is yours.
Well, just now before the briefing started, the chairperson of the CSIS asked me to speak first. But I told her that I would like Andrew to speak first and Sam, and I'm going to follow them too, because they know what's really going on there in Darfur in Sudan much more clearly, and they have engaged themselves there with the Darfur issue for much longer time than me myself. I was just nominated as the Chinese government's special representative for African affairs and as the special envoy to Darfur in this May. Since I ended my post, my service as ambassador there to South Africa for the past 6 years. I agree with what my colleague said, agree with the analysis about the practical situation, the practical difficulties and constraints the international community now is faced with. Before saying something more, I would like to quote the Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, because he visited Darfur, he visited Sudan, he talked with the people in the RDP camps there in Darfur, and he spoke with the senior government officials there and the NGOs in Sudan. He said that if you don't go to Sudan and go to Darfur and to see with your own eyes what's practically taking place there, you cannot imagine the complexity and difficulty the problem is. And as everyone knows that Sudan is the biggest African country in terms of land, and it's a transitional area to linking the Arabic world and sub-Saharan Africa with the Muslim religion and the Christian religion. And the country is really is in a very difficult situation. It has the problem there in the south, the four wars for the past 22 years with the SPLM. And according to the CPA, in the year 2011, it's going to be the referendum. The Southerners are going to decide whether they would like to remain in the United Sudan or to split away. And Sudan faced with the problem there in Darfur, the three states with the land of 500,000 square kilometers, larger than France, and with a population of 6 million, and with more than 50 different ethnic groups. And it had also the problem there in the east. They have the problem Eastern Front, but fortunately they reached agreement between the government and the Eastern Front with the support from Eritrean government. And they have some problems in the north, more or less. So the country is really in trouble. And If Sudan, the situation there in Sudan gets out of control, and so the spillover, the consequences might be very, very serious. It's just like to open a Pandora's box. The whole country, the whole area, the 9 neighboring countries might be negatively affected. So that's why what's happening there in Darfur is so serious. And that is why the international community are working together, whether we're from Beijing, China, and internationals from Washington, and from the AU, from the UN, and from everywhere, every corner in the world. We are now developing a kind of consensus. We are now more or less speaking in one language. We are now sending the same unified signal to the relevant stakeholders in Darfur. That is, we desperately need to make progress along the two tracks or the two fronts. That is the political process together with the hybrid operation. But to speak honestly, though we have made some progress along the two tracks, but now we are faced with a lot of challenges, a lot of difficulties. Well, a few weeks ago, me, myself, and Andrew Nasios met in Tripoli between the theater meeting. But it's really a kind of frustration for us. The two special envoys invited, I think, 28 factions or groups to come to the meeting. But unfortunately, only 12 committed to come. Actually, only 7 factions came. And all major factions, as the SRM, GM, they refused to come. They set up some preconditions which are no way to be met. So that meeting, or through that meeting, we as the international community tried to tell them directly that you have to come around the negotiating tables. You have to talk with the government. You have to some, even at least, a low degree of peace. So that only on that basis, the hybrid operation can be deployed. And if we go there as peacekeepers, we can have peace to keep. Otherwise, why should we go there? And the sad thing which happened is that the same day, that is the 25th of November last month, as soon as the first group of the Chinese engineering troops arrived there, almost the same day, threatening came openly from certain military commanders there of the, now what we would like to call them political movements, or formerly called rebels, because we like them to be, you know, part and parcel of the political process. They threatened openly to attack the peacekeepers from China, the multi-purpose, multi-functioning engineering troops. But their function there are just to building living quarters to the hybrid operation, for drilling water boreholes, for build roads, for make logistic preparations for the hybrid operation. And the record of the Chinese peacekeepers, I think, are good. That is recognized by everyone. And one of the basic principles for taking part peacekeeping is to keep neutrality. To keep neutrality. That is the precondition. And we are there to help you, to be part of the efforts of the international community. It's not going to be enemy of any political faction, of anyone there. We wish to be friends with all the people in Sudan, whether they are Arabic, whether they are from other ethnic groups. But from China, as wishes of the other countries, we are genuinely wish to have a fundamental or long-lasting solution to the problem there in Darfur, in Sudan as a whole. Because we know that if the situation gets out of control, that will be a disaster, not only for Sudan, not only for the region, not only for the African as a continent, but a disaster for the whole international community. No country wishes, that kind of scenario to be happened. So that's why we are doing something. We are doing our part of job, part of work to promote political process. We have committed to donate $500,000 to support the two special envoys for their work to bring all the splintering groups of the rebel forces together. And that is one thing. And we are not going to be threatened away, by certain military groups. The remaining peacekeepers from China will be soon deployed there. Altogether, they are going to be 315. And I think that is the first foreign troop to be deployed after the Annan three-phase plan was accepted. And on the hybrid operation deployment front, we also meet with some of the difficulties. Now we are working with the international community together, try to use our influence there over the government of unity there in Sudan, try to convince them to be more flexible, but honestly speak that they still have some difficulties. But anyhow, we are not pessimistic. We hope that something sooner or later will happen, and we hope that the progress to be made along that aspect of work. So the political will from the Chinese government has been there, and we have done something, and we are going to continue to work together with the African Union, with the United Nations, with our friends of the Western countries and other developing countries to try to push political process to make the ball rolling, to achieve more concrete developmental achievements, and to address the serious problems, particularly with regard to the humanitarian crisis, to the security situation, because the problem is very complicated, and the people there in Darfur are still suffering. They need help. They need concrete help. And this year we donated some 80 million RMB worth of humanitarian assistance goods, and all of them have been transported there to Sudan, and some of them there are already transported to Darfur itself. And we are going to provide more humanitarian assistance there, and also to provide water to Darfur region. A project of water supplying has already started by the Chinese companies to supply water to Niala area and to southern Darfur. Another big project, the Merowe Dam project, to provide electricity to all the three Darfur states and the neighboring states are getting on progress quite well. It's going to be completed soon in a quite advanced stage. So for seeing the above, I just want to send one message to the media or to the world that we are genuine and we are sincere and we are positive in making our own part of contribution to find a long-lasting fundamental solution to the Darfur issue, and in particular, and to the problem, to solve the problem in Sudan at large. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Liu, and in fact, to all three for really excellent and full presentations. I think we'll open up for questions now. We have just under an hour, and we can perhaps take a couple of questions at a time. And if you will identify yourself and your professional affiliation, that would be helpful. So why don't we open the floor for question? We have one here, the lady here, and a mic will come to you. Please wait for the microphone.
Hi, my name is Grace Kong, and I focus on UN peacekeeping at the State Department, so I'm very interested in progress in the deployment of UNAMID, and I'm very glad to have the chance to address a question to Ambassador Liu. We are very happy with the Chinese contribution of the engineers, and glad to see that many have been deployed at this point. But as you know, there are many other difficulties with UNAMID deployment at this point. And one major obstacle is the lack of helicopters for the mission, which yesterday Secretary General Ban pointed out as potentially causing the mission to outright fail if we don't get those helicopters. And so given China's very close relationship and strong relationship with Sudan, I would ask or would like to hear your views on the possibility of China contributing some of these very, very critical assets that are necessary for the success of UNAMID, given that, as you pointed out, that is a very important part for peace in Darfur and for the well-being of Sudan, which you are genuinely interested in promoting. So I would like to hear your views on that.
The Chinese government has taken part in peacekeeping missions in Africa for the past, say, almost 20 years in a quite active way. Now we have over 1,400 peacekeeping troops from China serving at seven missions in Africa, including the southern part of Sudan. There we have more than 400 Chinese peacekeepers. I think at the moment, the primary consideration, priority for the Chinese government is to fulfill our commitment to send 315 multi-purpose or multi-functioning engineering troops. We know that the hybrid operation in Sudan is the biggest one in the scale and magnitude the United Nations and African Union have ever committed, because it's involved with 26,000 personnel. The cost annually might be over $2 billion, and it needs the international community to work together and to make each country to make its own contribution. But at the moment, we are not ready to consider to send helicopters, because I know that they need altogether 8 attacker helicopters and 18 helicopters for the transportation. I think the United Nations Peacekeeping Department are consulting with other potential donors to see whether or not they can make their own contribution. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take a Jamera and then the gentleman here.
Thank you. My name is Jamera Roan, and I'm from Human Rights Watch. And I have two questions that are related. Number one, what is the political argument that you use with the Sudan government when the Sudan government tells you that they are sovereign and they do not have to obey what the international community says and obey the Security Council, number one? And number two, what discussions have you had with the Sudan government about what will happen with their oil revenue and your future participation in the oil business in the South in 2011 when the South becomes independent?
You have already made your conclusions that the Southerners will definitely choose to be independent after 2011. Well, China has been engaging the government of Sudan in the past few years before I myself was nominated as the representative of the government for the Darfur issue. At different levels, you know, this year in February, our president, President Hu Jintao, visited Sudan, and he himself met and talked with al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, and they exchanged ideas extensively with regard to the Darfur issue. Our president gave his advice to the Sudanese president. The general tone is that we advise him to show more flexibility with regard to the Darfur issue and to pay more attention to address the humanitarian problems there. And the other, you know, government officials, senior government officials, I mean the ministers, or deputy ministers, or some other senior officials, kept on visiting Sudan, and invited Sudanese leaders and ministers to visit China. We used all those, you know, occasions to talk around the government into showing more flexibility and into having better understanding of the request of the international community, and to be more sincere and to pay more attention to addressing real problems there in Sudan. As everyone knows here, that one of the basic principles the Chinese foreign government's foreign policy based on is that to respect national sovereignty and territorial integrity of each and every independent state. But we are doing things within the framework of that. We don't mean that we give advice and to certain governments is a kind of violation of that principle. And we do things rather as the equal partner of the government and to analyze the situation together with them to point out what is in favor of their long-term interests and what is not, and to convince or to try to convince them to have a better understanding of what needs to be done. And if certain things are not going to be done, and what the serious consequences might be, I think sometimes it works and sometimes it not works. But that is something quite normal. And even within a family, the husband and the wife are sometimes arguing or even fighting. And between state and state, or between two sovereign states, I don't think it's fair that people, you know, exaggerate the influence of China over, you know, another government. Even if we have quite close economic relations, even if we have some cooperation on the oil, but we regard it honestly. That kind of oil dealing is quite a normal commercial one. It's transparent. It's mutual benefit. It's nothing special, nothing unusual, because China's economy is developing. China needs energy or oil to support that economy. And that is something quite natural. To politicize that kind of relations is not, I think, in accordance with the reality, with the international practice. And one thing I would like to add is that we are also trying our best to commit ourselves to make our own contribution to the reconstruction and economic development in Southern Sudan. That is why we invited Tsava Gyaw, the first vice president of the Government of Unity of Sudan, to visit China in this July. And he met with our leaders, he met with our president. We committed ourselves to donate a moderate fund to train their people, to seek employment, to be skillful in doing certain practical work, and also to encourage the Chinese companies to go there to help them to in the infrastructure aspect. But actually, the Southern Sudan, the GOSS, the government of Southern Sudan, made the equal request for the Chinese government to give them help. And just a few days around this month, maybe next week, and a joint economic commission meeting between China and the government of unity of Sudan are going to be held in Beijing. So far as I know, that one of the topics is the development projects there in Southern Sudan, But according to the oil revenues, I think Andrew, he himself also visited Southern Sudan. I read some of his report or his speech on certain occasions. And now roughly so one third of the total revenue of oil, you know, goes to the Southern Sudan. And each year, more or less, Southern Sudan government got something around $1 billion, something around that. That fund is supposed to be used for developmental projects, but maybe in reality, a bigger proportion are going to be used for salaries or things like that. I don't know exactly. That's their own, you know, affairs between the South and North. We encourage that the revenues of oil to be used all country over, not only in the North, but also in the South. The southern part of Sudan desperately needs development assistance from the international community, particularly from countries who committed to give them ODA, or official development assistance, as a package of the CPA. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's take a couple, because I see a number of hands. The gentleman here, and then we'll go to Bob Pastor.
Charles Gurney, Atlantic Council of the United States. Andrew Natsios, I noted in your talk you spoke a lot about the politics of inclusivity, the suspicion that has been engendered as groups feel that they've been left out of various peace processes, and the fact that some of these groups are not yet ready to conclude a peace deal. Of course, the CPA, as it was starting to come together back in 2003, was really the origins of the Darfur conflict. And to a great extent, the Fur people and the people of Darfur were left out of the CPA. Some would even say that the thinking was, if we need to fight to get a place at the table, then we'll fight. I'm wondering to what extent that dynamic still affects the peace process. I guess the specific question is, what do the rebels want in order to conclude a peace process?
At least I will. I think a lot of very few people have actually read the CPA. The CPA actually applies to the whole country in many respects. Two critical aspects of it apply to Darfur and the rest of the North. One is revenue sharing. Oil wealth sharing is not just for the South. The provisions of the CPA call for a dramatic increase in the sharing of oil wealth with northern provincial budgets. Now, the argument would be, well, the Walis are all appointed by the central government, you know. But the fact is that at least the money would be spent in the provinces instead of in Khartoum, which is where it's spent now. Now, the problem is this year, and this is lost, the CPA instability right now, or fragility, is principally a problem of the North and the South. What a lot of people in the North are saying is we're getting hurt a lot more by the lack of implementation than the people in the South are. And that is because while the I don't remember all of the steps in the budgeting process. It's rather complex. But all of the steps, except for the final one, did dramatically propose an increase in the revenues that the provinces in the North could spend from oil revenues for this fiscal year. The final step was the finance minister sending the money out. And my memory is, unless I am, you know, I'm forgetting, my memory is they never sent the checks out. So that a critical element, is that true, Sam? The critical element of the CPA was violated in the North this year, which is very serious, I think. The second critical element of the CPA is the elections, which would take place practically, it says in the law, or in the CPA, I think it's before June or July of 2009. Realistically, if they're not held by February of 2009, they're not going to be held because of the rainy season. Once the rainy season starts, large parts of Sudan are completely impassable. And therefore, we've got basically a year and 2 months to put the machinery in place, which is going to be very complicated to do. And so that's a provision that covers the rest of the country, not just... So two critical elements, revenue sharing and power sharing, are elements of the CPA for the whole country. The problem is some people want other things. Some people want their own provincial government. They want to elect their own governors. They want a quasi-autonomous form of government, more like the Swiss model, I suppose, a confederal model. I'm not sure. A lot of the people who you're dealing with Many of the commanders are illiterate. They have never read any books. They can't read. And so you have conversations with them, and you know, they're not really familiar with political science. There is a small educated elite who are very sophisticated. They're lawyers, they're business people, and they do know this stuff. But below that, it's very thin. It's very thin. So trying to explain to a nomadic herder, an Abala Rizagat or a Zagawa who's been out in the bush, who's completely illiterate, you know, confederal systems of governance in Switzerland, I mean, there's a huge culture gap. And people think here in Washington they can have the conversations in the rural areas. They don't even know what all this is about. They have illusions about all this. Their notion of what the UN is profoundly different than what it is and what our understanding of it is. The UN, they think when the UN arrives that paradise is going to erupt. I had people tell me, all conflict will end, all crime will end, we'll get all our property back as soon as the UN arrives. They said, no, that's not true. It's not true in any UN peacekeeping operation anywhere in the world. You guys are living, and that's why some of them are saying, we want this first, and then we'll have the political negotiations. I said, no, it doesn't work that way. So there is a problem, I think, in the understanding of the CPA, even by some of the people in the Darfur don't understand what's in the CPA. The people who have memorized the CPA are the Southerners. They know every single word of it. Pastors and priests in the South actually give sermons on the CPA in church. People should think of it almost like Lincoln's proclamation ending slavery. That's how it's seen in the South. It's seen as a liberation document. So we see it as sort of a treaty and all that. It's not how it's seen in the South. Absolutely not. And John Garang, people think of him as a political leader. We did polling through NDI. The AID did it. Okay, you know how they describe John Garang? Not as a political leader, as Moses. When he died, and this is very serious, the Archbishop of the Anglican Church said, Moses has died. Our Moses has died. It's like Lincoln, Washington, and Moses all died at the same time for them. For their culture, he was in that sense. And so the people in Darfur are nowhere near that. They don't have a foreign political system, as Sam said. They don't have a hierarchy to negotiate with. The negotiating team of John Garang, I've known them for many years. They're as sharp and as sophisticated as the Northerners, and very tough. But that is not the case in Darfur at all. So we've got lots of issues in terms of the stages of political development. One of the things that's not commonly understood is the South is now forming a coalition, which John Garang talked about was never able to do, of what are called the marginalized people. They have been, with funding from the United States and Norway, I might add, they brought all the rebels down, or many of the rebels, not all of them. And 12 of the 13 rebel groups they brought down unified in some kind of coalition. Five groups were unified by the Eritreans, but they came down to Juba. And they announced last week, 17 of them, that they had unified in two groups. Okay. Then they invited Sheikh Musa Hillel. Do you know who he is? He's the most notorious war criminal in Darfur. He is hated on the African side of the conflict. He's an ally of the government. He's a major general in the Sudanese military. He went to Juba to protect the interests of his tribe, which he's an Abala Rizagat from one of the sub-tribes. He went to Juba to protect the interests of his tribe. The government is furious over it. The Mezaria Arabs from Kordofan province, 5,000 of them. Now, the Mezaria Arabs were the Janjaweed of the 1980s. They massacred far more Dinkas and Nuer than anything that happened in Darfur. 10 times more people died in the South than died in Darfur. 10 times. 2.5 million people, according to the U.S. Committee on Refugee, a detailed account by Millard Burr, okay, on how many people died. You know who did all the killing? The Mezaria Arabs. You know who just joined the SPLA in the South? 5,000 Mezaria Arabs. And I mentioned it to one of the Northern, and he went into a rage in front of me. These are their closest allies. They've joined the SPLA. The Beja Congress has signed a peace agreement in the Red Sea. They're supposed to go down there now, too. All of the peripheral areas of the country that have been left out are now down in the South negotiating some unified coalition. The North is furious, and I have to say they won't admit it, but I think they're scared. This is, you know what the South is doing now with the North? They're playing hardball politics. And the NCP is not used to anybody in 18 years playing hardball politics with them. I could go into more detail, but where there's media here, and I don't want to go get carried away here. But the situation is very fluid. It's changing. There's brinkmanship going on between the North and the South. And the Southerners, you know, say, we got you. You signed the CPA. You are going to enforce the CPA.
Sam, do you want to add anything on? No.
Okay. Okay. Bob.
My name is Bob Pastor. I'm a professor at American University, but also co-director of a group called the Elders, a group of 13 world leaders led by Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu that sent a mission of four to Darfur in Sudan in October, led by Tutu and Jimmy Carter, Lakhdar Brahimi, and Graca Machel. They just issued a report this week, and if you don't have the report and would like it, I'd be glad to either give you one or send it to you. I'd like to ask a question of each of the panelists, if I could. First, for Ambassador Liu, I think you've made a very strong case for both patience and the flexibility that you've asked of the Sudanese. This past week, or last week, the UN Undersecretary General said that there were very serious obstacles being placed in the path of an effective deployment of UNAMID, which should come into place in 3 weeks from now. In response to that, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Proposed the idea of targeted sanctions in order to bring the Sudanese government around. At what point will the Chinese government consider a proposal along those lines, keeping in mind that there are just 3 weeks left before UNAMID should be deployed effectively? Secondly, for Mr. Rabak, if you could, you talked about the difficulty of bringing the rebels to the negotiating table. And the AU and UN have done an effective job through the Darfur dialogue of trying to encourage civil society observation, if not participation in the talks. Is it possible that civil society representatives, perhaps even selected by an election in which perhaps the UN and the AU could supervise, might begin and might hasten and might expedite those negotiations, because they have a much greater stake in conclusion of those negotiations, perhaps, than the rebels? And then finally, for Ambassador Natsios, you talked about the CPA. You might. And therefore, I will cut this. The question for you is just an update on the North-South negotiations themselves.
Well, I know that the deployment of process of the hybrid operation is seriously lagging behind of the scheduled timetable, and is currently meets a lot of difficulties, and one of them is involved with the countries. Non-African countries to contribute troops to the hybrid operation. So far as I understand, and according to my engagement with the senior officials of Sudan, that currently their argument is that for the engineering troops, then the commitment from China, from Pakistan, and from Egypt are more or less enough now. And what seriously needed is helicopters and is transportation battalions. I think everyone knows about that. And I know that the international community is losing patience. And but my understanding is that the Sudanese government has not completely closed the door. And I hope that at maybe a later or later stage, there might be something, you know, possible happening. And also the international community, particularly the members of the Security Councils, are still working very hard, try to seek a kind of compromise, a kind of practical solutions to the problem now we are faced with regard to the deployment of the hybrid operation forces. And from China, we think that mechanism of the tripartite mechanism, I mean that the consultations among the AU, the UN, and the Sudanese government has been approved more or less effective. If we can recall that it's just after the high-level consultation between the three parties in Addis Ababa on June the 12th this year, the Sudanese government was finally convinced to accept the hybrid operation, the third phase of the Annan plan. And we think now, I know that the United Nations Peacekeeping Department has written to the government of Sudan, putting up the request of 13 things. But they consistently indicate that they are waiting for the reply or for the response from Sudan. 2 days ago, when I met Andrew Nasios, I suggested personally that why, you know, people at high levels from the AU, from the UN, from the Sudanese government can sit down, putting their heads together, and have a direct or face-to-face discussions to find out exactly what's the concrete concern of each party, of the government of Sudan. What's the really worry in their minds from the AU, from the UN, and try to find a kind of solution. I think we need to do that kind of high-level, you know, consultations directly, you know, in a peaceful atmosphere, frankly, exchanging ideas, and that is one way out. Another where area we need to take further efforts is that all the P5s, China, United States of America, UK, Britain, and Russia, are using our own channels to do our part of work so that deadlock could be removed and the stalemate could be removed and the ball can start rolling.
Very briefly, I don't think it is possible. Neither is it desirable to have the civil society to replace the current parties in the negotiations. I think we need to be a little prudent in terms of how we involve them. What is incontestable is the fact that you have to have the inputs from civil society and the victims of the conflict in any new process, if for nothing else to ensure that the people of Darfur would, at the end of the day, take ownership of the outcome of that process. I think we need, therefore, to find a formula that will bring in the civil society, speaking in generic terms, in a non-threatening manner to the traditional stakeholders of the conflict, the fighting groups in Darfur and the government of the Sudan. I just give you an example. When the talk started in Sirte, we were supposed to have a representative group of 25 civil society leaders at the talks. Because of difficulties with the government, we had only 12 of them. The rest could not make it. And those who came, when they returned to Darfur, they have been, most of them have been subject to all kinds of intimidation and threats. And if you know the nature of the Darfurian society, the polarization which has taken place, we need to be very careful in terms of how we involve this group of people. Because on both sides, of the movement and the government, their real genuine desire is not to have them at the talks at all. So they have done everything to create all kinds of problems. I think Mr. Natios, in his opening statement, alluded to the fact that the government had tried to prevent the involvement of these people in the talks, even their selection. Abdul Wahid has sent very direct messages, and we have evidence to that effect, that he is discouraging the people in the IDP camps, an important constituency for these talks. They are under threats. They have been threatened, their lives have been threatened, that if they participate in the political process, then they will not live to tell the story. So, I mean, when you see those kinds of situations, we need to be very careful. What we are trying to do now is to find a credible mechanism which will ensure that we have at least 2 to 3 concentric circles of process of selection of representatives of the civil society. First, to have some kind of symposium in which will bring together all of the people in some kind of a forum, and then they will be able to, in some democratic process, to select those who are going to represent them. Secondly, we are trying to stagger the involvement of the civil society, not just for them to come as tourists, but to come when particular discussions are held. For instance, the discussions on land. The discussions is that will not be between the government and the rebels, but you have to involve the people who are affected by the land problems in Darfur. So depending on the issue to be discussed, the nature of the selection, the criteria for the selection will have to be determined. And that process of consultations is underway as we speak. The DDDC PREPCOM and the UN Civil Affairs Department working together collaboratively with the JMSC. There is a tripartite mechanism which is being set up, but which is also being done in consultation, because it has to be transparent with the, at least to explain the criteria to the government, but also to engage the movements and to ensure that we have all of them supporting. But the only difficulty is, what do we do with Abdul Wahid? And I don't know, you will have to ask the French that. Thank you.
Okay, North-South negotiations. I think we were in, when I went there in late September, early October, I was shocked by the radical deterioration of relations between the North and South. There were 3 incidents that took place from March of this year until the crisis started, which are not widely known. They're not, at least they haven't been delineated this way. This is my analysis of it. The first thing is that for 2 months in the spring, the government of Sudan dramatically dropped oil revenues to the north, and it was a 90% cut, which caused a crisis to the south. And I might add that the total oil revenues for last year, Ambassador Liu was correct, was almost $1 billion. It was $950 million. This year, I'm not sure what the figure is, but it's probably $1.3, $1.4 billion. So it's dramatically increased. Almost a 50% increase this year over last year. But for those 2 months, which are earlier in the year, the drop looked like, and they said the reason we're dropping is because the oil, the sanctions by the United States. Now, this is before the sanctions were imposed, so it couldn't have had any effect on the oil revenues. It's ridiculous. They did it because the South, my memory is the South was quietly saying that they supported the sanctions against the North because of Darfur, which enraged the NCP. Okay, so the first thing that happened is the Southerners were extremely upset that the oil revenues dropped. The Southerners have said, you stop the oil revenues and you have a declaration of war. They've said that publicly, so it's not a secret, and repeatedly said it. But then they went back up again, dramatically, much more so than they were last year. The second thing that happened is there were standing orders that were given by the command structure of the SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces, to withdraw from all areas in the south by the deadline of July 9th, which was in the CPA. President Bashir sent personal orders out countermanding those orders in June. That enraged the Southerners, because all the troops that were left in the south were in the oil fields. They were all consolidated, and they stayed there, and that's where they still are. The third thing that happened was, this past summer, I was there in July, and this just as I was there, literally, there was a meeting of the second vice president, Ali Alsmataha, and the vice president of the GOSS, Riek Machar, on Abyei. There's a formal committee set up to negotiate this, and I met with the negotiators. The South made 4 compromises to the CPA. I mean, there were substantial changes to the CPA to compromise in Abyei, one of which was to allow the North to take revenues for 5 years past 2011. It's a very generous offer, in my view. And now the North never rejects anything. All they do is they refuse to act. They don't say anything. And, of course, when you make a generous offer like that, you expect some kind of response. And they simply diss them. That enraged the North. The South. The people were furious in the South. They were trying to be accommodating, and what was thrown back in their face. Because there is an element of the South, the Northern government, that never supported the CPA, does not support it now, does not want it to go through. The hardline, xenophobic, fearful. Now, I don't think President Bashir is in that category. And he is not, I think he was, for a period, he was siding with that faction between March and about a few weeks ago. About a month ago, I should say, the beginning of November. Now, what happened on November 2nd, when I was there, is they announced this agreement. Then, without going to all the details, it was announced by Salva Kiir on television and by Luca Byong-Deng on television and then by Bashir on television. But all of the issues except for Abiy had been dealt with. And I might add, privately, the hardliners in the South, because there's also a faction of hardliners in the South, just like there's a faction in the North, said, everything's been resolved. Even Abiy, we've made progress on. I said, really? Abiy, you've made progress? Absolutely. Now, when the hardliners said that to me, I said, really? I mean, it's one thing for the peace faction in the South to say that. It's one thing for the Archbishop of the Catholic Church or the Anglican Church to say. But it's quite another for the real hardline, old line people started the rebellion in the first place to say that. So I assumed this was serious and said that publicly. And what happened was, without going to all the details, is by Thursday of the following week, the committee that was supposed to implement the details of this agreement collapsed. Now, what since happened is quite interesting. As of 2 weeks ago, the Southerners told me and the Northerners told me that everything has been resolved except for Abiy, once again. All issues have been resolved except for there are eight issues. Seven of them, no, I'm sorry. There were nine issues, eight had been resolved. The ninth was Abiy. And the South said, we want Abiy dealt with first, and then we'll deal with the implementation of the other eight items. The North said, we want all eight items dealt with, and then we'll deal with Abiy. And there was an impasse. Now, we have cables this morning. I'm not going to go into the details of them. There appears to be there's a compromise being worked out. I think they realized how close they came. There were three military incidents in late October. One of them involved the death of 10 soldiers. They were starting to shoot each other, including one officer from the North. The second incident was very serious. Two battalions almost went into a conventional confrontation. It would have been very bloody if it had happened. I told both sides, if you get soldiers close and it looks like they're going to start shooting, you call up each other at a senior level immediately, no matter how much the tensions are there, and stop it immediately. And that's what they did. Salva called Bashir, and they both pulled the troops back just in the nick of time. Literally, the UN told me it was right on the edge of a shooting war. The command and control in the North and the South is not very good, frankly. And so what Salva's been doing, and I want to commend Salva Kiir, lots of people make criticism of Salva. I think Salva Kiir has done a remarkable job under great stress in keeping things moving in the right direction. He does not want to return to war because he was one of the most senior commanders. He knows how terrible the war was in terms of Southerners. And Salva told me, unless we're attacked, we are not going to attack. We're not going to attack. So he directly connected with his commanders in the field to restrain them, to make sure there was control. And I think President Bashir actually restrained his troops as well. Thank heaven. We came very close, very close. I think what's happening now, this week, a good sign has taken place. That is, we have evidence that there was a 5-point plan I put together that we discussed that no one, we didn't sign anything, but it was put together early November at the same time that, I'm sorry, not early November, early October. It was 2 months ago, more than 2 months ago. And in that, I want to go into all the details of the plan, but one of the elements was to send joint integrated units immediately into a demilitarized Abiy, take the troops from the North and South out point, take the joint integrated units which are called for under the CPA, put them in there. Apparently, some units have already arrived, which is a very good sign. Okay, and they've agreed to pull their troops back We're getting this report now in the last few days. And then most importantly, all the northern troops need to withdraw from the south to the 1156 border, which is what we proposed in early October. And then the southern troops, some of which, a substantial number of troops, are in Blue Nile and are in Anuba Mountains. They need to pull back to the south. If that happens, then the risk of an unintended conflict will diminish substantially. And then they can work out the rest of the agreements. Now, Abyei will remain, and I want to just say this, it will remain a very serious threat to peace in Sudan between the north and the south. It must be dealt with. And the north cannot simply delay and delay, which is what they've been doing. Now, there are proposals. The International Crisis Group has made some. We've made some. The Norwegians have made some. And the Southerners have made some. We urge both sides to sit down at a very senior level, at the level of the presidency, which is what had been agreed to. It's been agreed to now that the issue of Abyei will be settled in the presidency, which means President Bashir, Salva Kiir, and Ali Asmataha, the second vice president. And it will be resolved at that level. If they can deal with the issue of oil and the issue of land and the issue of the Mezaria Arab nomadic grazing rights, and I don't want to go into all the details of this. There are many different nuances to that, and how they're put together can have a profound effect on whether this is acceptable. I think Abyei can be dealt with. If it is not dealt with and the North continues to delay this, it's really going to risk a conflict. And I have to say, this is not going to look like the conflict of the 1980s and 90s. This is going to be two conventional wars. It's going to be terrible. So we were watching this carefully. We've made an offer to help mediate this with other people, and you can't force people to mediate, you know, to be a mediator. They have to ask you. And both sides said to me when I was there in October and in November, do not withdraw from, you know, keep your ideas, keep your proposals to mediate. We may need you if we cannot reach a conclusion on this. But at this point, we're going to try to resolve this ourselves. And I might add, the best resolution of this is for them to resolve it, not for us to resolve it. The best resolution of this is for the Sudanese to deal with their own problems. If that can happen, then outside mediation might be appropriate. And the last point I want to make, there are people who are going to call for the UN and the AU to get involved in the North-South stuff. I think it's, personally, this is not a position of our government, although I think there's a lot of sympathy for it in our government. We haven't made a decision on this. It's a bad idea for the UN and the AU to be doing Darfur and the North-South, because I know what the North will do and maybe even the South. They will play the two against each other. It will complicate Darfur enormously if they start having the same mediators for both. I think the guarantors of the North-South Agreement, which are the contact group in Europe, which is the Norwegians, the United States, and the British, and then there's extra countries that have been added, and the neighboring countries in the South, which is to say the Ugandans, the Kenyans, and the Ethiopians. Secretary Rice was just in a meeting with Jendai Frazier on this in Addis, which we organized, our government organized, with our partners. Sudanese did not go, which is too bad. Sudanese in the north didn't go. The SPLM was there. To push the notion of a resolution of this through the same mechanisms that were used to negotiate in the first place. And so I think we need to separate these two things, or we're going to, I think, paralyze both. That's my personal opinion, my personal opinion. Does that help?
We are just about out of time. For the greatest good, for the greatest number, I'll take just a couple of very quick questions and then turn back and for very brief answers combined with kind of wrap-up remarks from our panelists. So the gentleman there, the lady next to him, will take these in a batch. And
hi, I'm Mike Davis with the Universal Human Rights Network, and my question is to Mr. Nacios. As a small group, and I've actually visited Darfur, I wanted to know what can those of us who are small and don't have enormous budgets to spend $15 million on a public relations campaign or flood your office with calls, what can we do to have a voice in what's going on, those of us who don't agree with the humanitarian intervention or boycotting the Olympics? And secondly, the SPLA and the SPLM have a very definite connection to the SLA and the SLM. And when the late John Garang was alive, they were nurtured. What kind of pressure is being put on the SPLM, SLA, to have them engage in the peace process with Darfur?
Should we take this one a couple minutes so we can wrap up?
Yeah, I'll make this very quick. This is my view, again. I think too much focus has been put on the advocacy community on just Darfur. We shouldn't say we're going to save Darfur. I guess I am being critical. It should be to save Sudan, not save Darfur. You can't save Darfur and ignore the rest of Sudan. It can't be done. Other people get really, the Southerners are furious, I have to tell you. They've told me that everybody focuses all the time on Darfur. What about us who had 10 times more casualties? We negotiated a peace agreement. No one seems to care about that. And I have to say it's complicating our diplomacy because few people in this city are focused on what's in the north-south. If the CPA gets back on track, it will facilitate what's happening in Darfur. If it continues to be off track and there's a risk of conflict, we're never going to get Darfur fixed. In fact, the whole country is going to be at risk. So I think you can help us refocus attention on the whole country, one, and two, specifically on the CPA, which both sides have signed and a lot has been implemented, but some other things that are critically important have not been implemented. So I think that could be a contribution of your group and other groups that want to balance this debate out. I am not suggesting that the Save Darfur has not provided huge service. There's been a dramatic drop in civilian casualties this year versus last year. There's still casualties, and they're terrible. I think the reason for the drop is because of the pressure of the international community and the Save Darfur campaign. They're afraid now. They're afraid. But we need to go beyond that now and look to the larger structural issues that are at work in the rest of the country. And the most important right now, because we have an agreement that's signed, we have a tenuous peace, is the CPA.
Thanks. Actually, I think we are now out of time, but I do want to just give Ambassador Liu, Sam, and Andrew a chance for perhaps just a concluding remark or two.
Well, it's really a great honor for me. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for coming here to listen to us. I mean, Andrew and Sam. For our views with regard to Darfur, with regard to the problem between the South and the North, with regard to Sudan. I think for the international community, particularly for the United Nations, African Union, China, the United States of America, actually we are working along the same line. So sometimes when I had the interview with the correspondents or reporters to meet the media people, they would generally refer, you know, to something like how the U.S. criticizing China for this or that. I would point out each time that you have to distinguish, is that the U.S. administration, the NGO, the media, or things like that. Actually, between the two governments, we have very good communication and dialogue. We know each other perfectly well, our position, and we are trying to work together, not to confront each other, and to work together for promoting peace and for seeking a practical and fundamental solution to the problem there in Sudan, in Darfur, in the South, because we think that's in the interests of both our two governments and in the interests of the international community. And for the government of China, and we have been consistently supporting the African Union's special role with regard to the Sudan issue because it's the paramount continental organization. It has done a lot and is continuing to do. It's part of the work and very difficult situation and the financial constraint, and we are going to continue to do that. We are willing to work together We are willing to cooperate. We are willing to send unified signals to all the relevant stakeholders there in Sudan, whether it's the Sudanese government or the rebel leaders or civilian societies, for a better solution. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador.
I have had the privilege of being here for 2 days, and I can tell you I've learned an awful lot listening to people. Sometimes I think it's best to do the listening, because some of the most important experiences have been shared here in the last 2 days, and I want to thank the Center for putting this together. I want to thank you particularly for bringing the Americans and the Chinese together on Darfur, because I think it is important. I wish that the Japanese were also here, and the French. It would have helped us. I wish that the countries of the region neighboring to Darfur would have been here to listen. But I wish most importantly that we all can continue to hold hands together and to help the people of Darfur, because at the end of the day, this is about the people of Darfur. They have been traumatized. They have gone through what is unimaginable in this day and age in our world, you know, today, where you are seeing people, regions building together, regrouping, and making advances. In Darfur, Darfur is still living in some centuries back. I don't know what century that is. About the point that was raised by the gentleman there about the SPLM and the SLA, let me just say for the records that we of the African Union, and I believe with the United Nations, have appreciated the role that the SPLM have played in the last couple of weeks in terms of bringing together these movements. One of the things that undermined our efforts in Libya on the 27th of October was over the issue of representation, because we didn't have the correct formula to bring together 27 or whatever the number of groups are. And the fact that the SPLM has been able in that space of time to bring these numbers, at least those who were in Juba, to two groups, makes our life a lot easier, because you know that if you have to issue invitations now, you have two distinct groups. So if for nothing else, that is important. But we have also said to the SPLM, you have taken it as far as you can go. Now is the time to make a transition to another phase of the project. So we want to say that the SPLM does have a role, and we should not try to discourage them from that role. If you are going to go into the negotiations, you're going to need the SPLM. Because the issues which are going to be negotiated, you will need the understanding of the SPLM as a party to the CPA. And you're going to need them to work under the auspices of the Government of National Unity. And we should know that the SPLM have two particular experiences which would be useful for us. They have waged a military campaign in the Sudan, and they have also participated in negotiations. So, and these are the two issues which are on the table right now with the movements. But finally, to say that the beginning, the coming together, the synergy which we are beginning to see internationally on the Darfur issue or the Sudan issue augurs well for the process. I want to appeal for some level of patience with the Darfurians, because the process is not going to be easy. In fact, the difficult job begins now, and we have to encourage them. We have to nudge them on, but we have to also consistently encourage them to participate. What they are doing is that they are playing out their worst fears, because they are dealing with an opponent which is not very good at keeping promises or implementing agreements, and they have seen it happen in other instances, and they are asking us, what is the point of going into this process, because we'll end up like Salva Kiir, we'll end up as like Mini Minawi, because nothing is going to be implemented. And to some extent, they have a point. So we have to level the playing field, and the playing field can only be leveled if we deal with both sides, deal with the government, put all of the pressure on the government, but also put a lot of pressure on the movements, particularly those ones who are staying in 5-star hotels in the West, in Paris, and all kinds of places. Where they belong is Darfur. They should. I think I go to Darfur more often than a lot of the Darfurians who are making the loudest of noises. Yes, they have to stay outside and to mobilize, but you should also tell them that it is their responsibility, that their region is bleeding, and the region needs them. They need them on the ground. They need them to lead. You can't be a leader and lead from the comfort of a luxury home in Paris. you know, while your people are suffering. So I think you need to help us there. And I think the advocacy role that which many of you are playing have brought Darfur to the attention of the world community. We now need to maintain that attention because, again, you know, Darfur can easily slide into Somalia. I mean, it's not very far. I mean, it's not unimaginable. So let's deal with Darfur while the whole world is focused on Darfur. And I want to thank the international community. I want to thank Mr. Natios and the United States. It has a force. It is a force for good in Darfur, and I can confirm that. And I welcome the involvement and the new role of the Chinese, the positive role which they can play. I think we need to encourage them to continue to do that. My final note, help us to encourage the African Union and the United Nations to work together, because I think if we work together and if we improve our working methods and if we're able to really work together as a good team in partnership, we will be better able to serve Darfur. Thank you.
Just to our panelists, thank you so much for joining us, the time you spent. I think we're all enriched by this, and we welcome you back, and hopefully with a larger coalition next time as well.